Thank you very much for this generous presentation and all of you for being here. I'm going to develop my presentation in a few steps. In the first part, I will try to give you some basic normative conditions for the second part of my presentation, which has to do, first of all, the second part, with the definition of representative democracy, already anticipated in some sense, but is important for me now, again, as a hierarchy of power between the will and judgment, and this will allow me to make my final argument concerning the problem of risk to democracy coming from the world of opinion formation and within the instrument of media instrument that creates today some problems to democracy, to say the least, at least. As you can see, I mean, well, I'm Italian, so I have some problems concerning opinion formation and manipulation. So I'm not ashamed to say that beneath this interest there is the understanding of something that is very close to me, but according to me it's not simply a phenomenon confined to one country or one situation. It's a real general problem and maybe or can be faced as such also in other countries, certainly also in the States, as also the Tea Party organizations and the problems of manipulation of consent or opinion as proposed in recent months. Anyway, so let's start with this presentation. And then we start by reminding you that 20 years ago, this time, perhaps 19 years ago, but Francis Fukuyama published his book on the end of history. His famous thesis, an adaptation of the Hegelian dialectics, was that the end of the Cold War marked the end of history because it coincided with the actualization of liberalism, the idea, the master idea of Western civilization. To Fukuyama, two facts prove the triumph of liberal democracy. First, the total exhaustion, this is his expression, of all other alternative visions, and second, the conversion to liberalism of his enemies. So his thesis was engrafted within a non-falsifiable assumption in relation to which any question of legitimacy was exogenous and inappropriate. Indeed, if liberal democracy, according to him, was able to win against his enemy, it was not because it embodied a normative value, but because it proved to be in agreement with the character of modern society. Liberal democracy was selected by the invisible hand of history, which rewards functional consistency and is indifferent to human will and desiderata. Now, what interests me here is not, of course, to propose you a critical appraisal of Fukuyama's philosophy of history, but the study of some problems internal to contemporary democracy, problems that his condition of planetary solitude, in this sense the end of history, makes perhaps more stubborn. Planetary solitude means that there is no legitimate or conceived as legitimate form of government alternative to democracy. In this sense, I use the expression solitude. So democracy does no longer have an elsewhere. Yet this is not because, as according to Fukuyama, it is the final station of history, but for reasons that are intrinsic to its nature, reasons that can be detected whenever we reflect on the three basic conditions of democracy, that is to say, political equality, immanence in the process of justification, and means and ends consistency. I will briefly elucidate these three basic conditions because are important in order to make then the further argument concerning what to do with the risk to democracy coming from the domain of opinion. So the first condition, political equality, can be rendered as follows. It is hardly possible to hypothesize a form of government that is able to honor individual liberty without distributing political power equally among those who are supposed to obey. Isaiah Berlin argued in 1958 that liberty from interference, or liberty in the true sense, can be equally respected or violated in an autocracy and in a democracy. That is, in other words, seen from the perspective of the protection of negative liberty, democracy is not the best government. However, Berlin did not say that this holds true also in the case we take as our reference point, the equal liberty of not suffering an arbitrary interference from those who rule. Equal liberty. So Berlin had to narrow the concept of individual liberty to dissociate it from any form of government and democracy in particular. But if we are consistent with the principle of equal liberty, the conclusion that political order is indifferent to its protection cannot be sustained consistently. I would propose, therefore, we follow Norberto Bobbio's definition of the unavoidable nexus of liberty and democracy, a nexus that was before him proposed by Hans Kelsen. The quotation is the following: it is hardly probable that a non-liberal state can ensure a correct functioning of democracy, and on the other hand, it is hardly probable that a non-democratic state is capable of guaranteeing fundamental rights. The historical evidence of this interdependence lies in the fact that a liberal state and a democratic state, when they fell together. In conclusion, in order for liberty to be secured, their minimal conditions are needed: that all citizens have the right to participate directly or indirectly in the making of the laws. That decisions, second, are made according to procedures that contemplate the equal contribution of all, thus by majority, the majority and the minority together. And finally, that the participants are in the condition of choosing among different alternatives, which means that they are free to express their ideas, discuss and try to extend the support of their ideas, associate with others, and finally change their mind. In a word, individual liberty is the substance of democracy, or, said otherwise, the equal condition of political participation translates into liberty. The second condition, the immanent nature of democratic justification of legitimacy, entails that democracy's foundations are not above or outside, but in the very political process the democracy puts in action. The main contemporary theorists of democracy, John Dewey, Hans Kelsen, and Eugen Habermas, have explained this radical immanence by arguing that democracy doesn't need to conjecture the existence of a pre-political nature as the site of some inalienable rights in order to justify and respect those rights. To the contrary, democracy shows itself precisely when a community of men and women adopts the instrument of rights in order to solve its internal conflicts and disagreements and to regulate their public relations. We cannot have democracy if we don't have individual freedom, or what we call today rights, basic rights. They implicate each other if it is true that in a democracy politics is made of an open, plural, and public expression of opinions, of a dialectic forum within which only political consent can emerge or change, and dissent has full right to exist and be made public. Finally, the third condition, the correlation between means and ends, it's very important because it is correlated to, also it is correlated to the previous two, and claims that in no other political system, as in a democracy, it is crucial that means and ends are not in contradiction. If democracy doesn't allow for shortcuts, it is because it is not merely a functional way to search for to reach some ends or any kind of ends. The goodness of the end doesn't justify the violation of the democratic procedures of decision making. So this is a crucial condition which disclaims any attempt to make democratic politics subservient to, for instance, truth. Democracy's promise is liberty, not truth, not epistemic truth. It is liberty as the participation, directly or indirectly, of all the citizens in the determination of the laws that regulate those life domains in which they agree not to follow their own private will, as according to Condorcet. So democracy doesn't promise decisions that are more correct or truer than, for instance, those achieved by an aristocracy, because it does not promise that by including all the citizens, it can reach more valuable outcomes. To democracy, the outcome is much less relevant than the procedures according to which the outcome is reached, because its main preoccupation is with liberty. As a matter of fact, any outcome is exposed to contestation and its and the legitimate attempt to be revised. Thus, the three norms of equality, immanence, and means and ends, convergence or non-contradiction, all of the three converge in the idea that democracy's political world is invariably characterized by opinions, and the criteria of political judgment are not independent standard, but immanent to the political process. It is very important that we start from opinion, because the criticism of manipulation of opinion is not meant to overcome opinion and to achieve an epistemic conception or interpretation of democracy. The three conditions together make sense of Alexis de Tocqueville's maxim, according to which democracy doesn't give us the certainty of excellent decisions or correct or good decisions. What it gives us, it is the certainty we can amend and change all decisions without calling into question or revoking the political order. In sum, we amend democracy by making the political process more, not less, democratic. Said otherwise, to be preserved, these three democratic conditions require that political equality be enriched or complemented with other kinds of equality. The topic of my presentation pertains to a peculiar kind of equality, though. Equality in the opportunity that citizens should or hope to have to participate somehow in the process of opinion formation. As Jerome Barron wrote 40 years ago in the Harvard Law Review, I quote, "There is inequality in the power of communicating ideas, just as there is inequality in economic bargaining power. To recognize the latter and deny the former is quixotic." Yet, once we recognize that democracy's political world is made of opinions or communications of ideas, we have also to recognize that the public information is vital to the creation of an informed citizenry, and that a democratic approach to freedom of information should entail not non-interference by the government, but a politics of regulation whose goal is to secure equal opportunity in the access to the means of communication. Now, an additional note I need to make before developing my arguments. The aims of the third condition, means and consistency, is a combination of two kinds of actions. They are very important in democracy, one tonic and one depressant. Let me explain what I mean by that and why it's important we pay attention to this. To clarify, both the democratic creation of self-correcting strategies and their specific character, whether tonic or depressant, I need first to cast light on the originality, not mainly of democracy, but of representative democracy, because it is in relation to representative democracy that it is not unreasonable to say that today democracy doesn't have an elsewhere, and thus all the risks that democracy is facing come from inside of it, not from outside. It is in relation to it that we can detect problems of blockage or back functioning of a democratic process or the violation of the above mentioned circumstances. Now, why is it important to say that only democracy was able to fulfill the condition of persistency and immanence and neutralize its internal enemies by making them co-participant in the political game? This is an important point, because the ancient demos never succeeded in incorporating the oligarchs, and anti-democracy conditioned persistently the ideological and institutional identity of democracy, as the myth of tyrannicide shows. As Joshua Ober, among others, recognized, the myth of the tyrannicide shows the liberal and tolerant nature of democracy, which didn't eliminate its enemy nor deny them freedom of expression. However, it also shows that direct democracy was never able to incorporate its enemies. And the enemies are the few, the aristocrats. And the elsewhere remain, for this reason, always an effective, concrete, and legitimate possibility for the few. Now, modern democracy, representative democracy, succeeded in changing that condition of endogenous precariousness by drafting constitution and adopting electoral representation. In this way, democracy took away from these natural adversaries, the few, the object of contestation, the radical dissent on who has the right of making decisions and judge. Now, since the start thus, and this is very important for me at least, the location of the few in the system of political decision was the problem that threatened democracy, the location of the few. The struggle between the few and the many, as we know, played a central role in Aristotle's theory of good constitution, forms of government, but was clarified more effectively by Niccolò Machiavelli, who simplified that dualism with a consistent theory of the forms of government that contemplated only two forms: government by the few, either monarchical or oligarchic, and government by the many, popular or democratic. Machiavelli associated the forms of government with passions and depicted a republican politics as a dialectic between tonic and depressant strategies. In his discourse, he reminded the enemies of the government of the multitude that it is not the many that have the desire for power and an active participation in politics, but the few. To the many, he says, it is enough to know they are securing their personal liberty, property, and domestic tranquility. To be non-dominated is for them sufficient, but it is not for the few, who long instead for power, either because they have substantive interests to protect or because they have strong passion for ruling. Thus, for reason of class or individual character, the few are the destabilizing force, not the many. in order to make popular government safe and lasting, it would have been thus necessary to give the few a chance, a place in democracy, so as to satisfy their interest and passion for power. So it would have been necessary to contain the hubris for power of the few through a form of participation and control that involved the many. As democratic history, as modern history shows, the constitution and political representation were able to achieve this important goal. And for this reason, modern democracy was able to defeat its own enemies. So seen from this angle thus, not only representative government is not a violation of democracy, but is a means able to strengthen it by creating the procedures of self-containment. That is to say, by making the power of the many essentially indirect and negative, power of veto, control, surveillance, for instance, and that of the few limited in time and intensity or function. Thus, it is our representation as the device thanks to which the few have been incorporated in the system that we should focus our analysis in order to cast light on the problems peculiar to contemporary democracy and their corrective strategies. It is a consolidated idea in modern political thought that representation is a violation of the democratic principle of direct participation. This idea is the daughter of a conception of sovereignty that had as its only axis the will, because it was centered on the formal act of decision, and the will of the sovereign is the law within the tradition of the juridical political tradition that developed from Jean Baudin to Rousseau to Kashmir, just to finish. If political liberty or autonomy is located in the act of decision, then Rousseau was right, because it is certainly true that the will cannot be represented. Yet representation put in motion the paradigm of the primacy, the paradigm of the primacy of the will and decisions, because it activated the power of opinion and judgment. That is to say, a political process of decision that is truly complex, not identifiable with a fiat, not located somewhere, but able to activate the sovereign citizens well beyond the electoral act of authorization or the formal expression of the will. Representation has, for this reason, contributed to change the very concept of the people by making it plural and articulated and conflictual. Never an homogeneous mass or an organic collective that speaks with one voice and at one time and is identical with the ideas of the elected leaders. A people that is made instead of citizens who vote as singular individuals, don't practice their vote right as an act of acclamation, and participate through various venues in the formation of the public judgment over the functioning of the state and the behavior of their representatives, that is to say, over the law and the political agendas. So an important conclusion of this interpretation is that in modern democracy, the violation of the principle of equal liberty can easily become a violation of political representation, and never abandon temptation to transform it, as Schmitt proposed, in the mystical representation of the people, an entity that is intolerant of inner diversity and discriminates against minorities and dissent. Does not tolerate it. A kind of representation that is opposite of political representation, which is not only a means to unify a collective sovereign, but also a complex process that filters, refines, amplifies ideas and interests emerging within society so as to make them contribute in the work of formation and expression of the political will of the demos. Clearly, although democracy requires that the right to vote is equally distributed, it does not extend this principle to the representative voice and the indirect influence of opinion. If it is true that representation involves the activation of a more subtle and complex power than authorization, namely the power of opinion and judgment, of creating opinion and giving them political effectiveness, then for citizens to participate in the making of political life of their country, some extra efforts are needed besides going to the ballot. In modern democracy, participation requires associational skills, time, and financial means, along with advocates who are willing to engage in a cause and be effective in advancing it. The problem is that these means are naturally exposed to inequality because they rely upon energies external to human speech and reason, such as money, technology, time. To conclude this introductory part, should we say that modern democracy has won its battle against its internal enemies and neutralized all possible alternatives? Now, if we reflect upon the hierarchy of power between will and judgment that lie at the core of modern democracy, we can perhaps give an answer that is ambiguous and skeptical. Let us say why, and go back to the hierarchy of will of opinion, which is extremely relevant to my argument. In ancient times, the risk to democracy came from the side of the decision-making power, the will. That risk translated into the oligarchs depriving the many of their right to sit in the assembly and the popular juries. Today, risks come instead from the side of opinion. They come not from the side of the authoritative will, voting, but from the side of indirect power of judgment or opinion formation. Rousseau presaged the tyrannical potential of speech when suggested that the citizens should, when gathered in the legislative assembly, vote in silence. Silence was a condition for liberty. Yet Rousseau was reasoning from inside a direct government perspective, in which voting in silence could still occur without depriving citizens of their liberty, because the will translated immediately into judgment without time and intermediary process in between. But this would be completely impossible in a representative or indirect democracy, a form of government that needs free speech and opinion as life needs oxygen, because voice is the most important means citizens have to make their ideas and interests visible, although their voting is secret and made in silence. The process that prepares it is public and noisy. So I would thus propose to frame today's dilemma with the following question: how to protect the political agonistic domain of public formation from the indirect kind of despotism — this is an expression coming from Condorcet — indirect despotism that can grow from the power of opinion, without renouncing political representation and without violating free speech? To answer this question, we should keep in mind that, like with ancient democracy, also in contemporary democracy, the threat comes always from the few, not the many. It is not the theory of majority, the problem that interests our democracies does, also because, as Mill understood it immediately, almost one century and a half ago, in a representative system, it is at any rate a minority of citizens that hold in their hands the game of words and the means to influence the opinions of the large public. So in consolidated democracy, like in ancient democracy, the risk to the equal liberty comes from the few, not the many, which are at the most an instrument manipulated by those who have more opportunity, economic and technological, to forge public opinion. In a beautiful essay by Condorcet in 1793 called The Meaning of the World Despotism, he made this incredibly important point against those who think that mob rule is a form of despotism, saying that, in fact, the mob is mobilized by somebody and at the most is a following factor, not the prior factor of despotism. Now, if in ancient democracy the object of contestation between democrats and anti-democrats was the right to sit in the assembly and the popular juries, as we said, in representative democracy the object of contention is much more elusive and difficult to prove, because citizens' political participation in public life is always indirect, not only in the form of voting on law, but also substantively, because it relies upon data, interpretations of data, information that citizens don't produce by themselves directly. Modern democracy is completely based on indirectness, much more than the ancient one. I don't have time to go, but if you like, I would like in the conversation, show the difference that it's very important to understand what does it mean to have a self-sufficient power of judgment, as according to Aristotle, and a judgment that is not self-sufficient, as the one that we have today. But let us go on for now. Now, whereas in ancient republics, the only intermediary between the people and the politicians was the herald, as in Aristotle's beautiful expression, in modern democracy, a panoply of institutions and means of communication and information puts in motion many intermediary actors who run also the system of choosing representatives, developing political programs, forming opinions on the many issues that will become an object of public deliberation. Thus, modern citizens are more passive, not merely because they do not make laws directly, but actually because they receive both data and interpreted data upon which their opinion and decision are to be made from the media and the parties. Most of the time, they are public, like we are when we go to a theater, that is, participant in a very passive way, as judgment in this case is. Representative democracy is a comprehensive system, thus, of political indirectness that embraces both the will and judgment. Now, modern democratic states have devised several strategies to make possible the institutional organization of democracy and make possible these layers of indirectness, which are very important to limit power, as we know. Separation of power, the autonomy of justice from politics, regular elections, secret and equal ballot, freedom of religion, and so on and so forth. All these strategies of indirectness together define what we call democracy. But among these several strategies, those that pertain or refer to the world of opinion formation and diffusion are undoubtedly the most difficult to manage. As Habermas told us in a very, perhaps his best book, the book on the formation of public sphere of 1962, until the 18th century, when it was given a name and recognized as the influencing force of competent judgment forming clubs or by journals or magazines, public opinion was identified with individual freedom of ideas and was given a protective role against the absolute power of the sovereign. Free speech was born as negative liberty against the state. But with the stabilization of representative government and the conquest of universal suffrage, however, opinion became gradually also a means of government, not solely a means for monitoring, limiting, reacting against the government. The term government by opinion was coined by 19th century liberals who wanted to call attention on the growth of a new insidious power. Beginning with that century, the 19th century, the meaning and function of the public sphere have changed, and from monitoring and checking power acquired gradually the nature of an agent and forger of an intrusive power, a mechanism that could obfuscate power rather than reveal it. This transformation was timely perceived by liberals like Mill and Tocqueville, who realized that public opinion plays two functions that can easily find themselves in a conflict. A preventive and protective function. Public opinion is directly associated with freedom and individual rights and the monitoring power, but also the ability of creating power. And the latter can easily escape citizens' control, although acts always with their complicity. How can we intervene on this power without subverting its negative character and without violating individual liberty? This is the amazing challenge facing a democracy that has defeated all its external enemies and does not have an elsewhere. The risk to democracy came today from within itself, and moreover, they come from the factor that makes it possible and viable, that is precisely opinion. 19th century liberals have been the first theorists to detect this problem and try to devise possible strategies or solutions. They have proposed strategies that I would call Platonist in character, because intended to exalt rather than contain the role of the few. For instance, by suggesting the formation of a class of intellectuals or competent citizens that weaken the power of the men. The solution they proposed were not in agreement with the three normative conditions of democracy. They were the presence of the political participation of the many rather than tonic, and they were tonic of the participation of the few rather than the present. These solutions were actually conceived in the view of introducing elements of inequality and breaking the rule of the democratic coherence of the means with the ends. For instance, Mill went back to Cicero's idea of an open ballot so that the few would control the opinion of the many. More modern, yet not less problematic from a democratic perspective, was the proposal advanced by Walter Lippmann in 1922, creating an independent class of experts in political and social questions, the equivalent of today graduate and doctorates in political science, that make, I quote from him, that make the unseen facts intelligible and known to those who are to make decisions. So whereas Mill proposed to intervene on the governed by inhibiting and taming their passions and prejudices, Lippmann proposed instead to intervene on the governing class by illuminating his job with the competent advisory device of a skillful class. Yet regardless of their different targets and strategies, for both Mill and Lippmann, the reference model to contain democracy, the democracy of the public, was Plato's guardianship. They criticized democracy of the public from the perspective of an epistemic vantage point or standards of judgment independent of the procedures. They violated all the three normative conditions of democracy. And although their solution cannot convince a democrat, the problems they raise are central and still awaiting for satisfactory solutions. Bernard Manin has written that while in the classical age of representative democracy, electors were sacred, in the age of audience democracy, the public is sacred. A tribunal that does not have a competent organ and for which nobody is directly or personally responsible. While the elector was an abstract entity that made possible the counting of preferences with mathematical certainty, thus deactivating any reason for contestation, the public is an entity that is not measurable and is generative of contestation. Above all, contrary to the elector, which presumes the existence of a reference point that is external to it, the citizen in his social life, the public doesn't presume an outside in relation to which to be evaluated. It does not have a dualistic perspective. The public is total because it is on the same time fictional representation and reality for the public actors and the democratic procedures. Furthermore, it is on the same time a medium that makes possible communication among individuals holding different ideas and interests, and it is an actor endowed of his own conditions and autonomous power. Above all, it operates indirectly and is not translatable into objective causal relationship. In mediatic democracy, the imaginary environment which Lippmann analyzed and discussed in 1922 is expanded to the point of being the environment tout court, a place that is inhabited by the public, which is itself immaterial and ungraspable. Actor and means for action, one may say, are identified in character and substance. In the democracy of the public, described by Bernard Manin, any distance between reality and fiction, or reality of opinion, and those who make them seems to be annulled. What are the answers we dispose of that they are not contradiction? They are not in contradiction with these normative conditions of democracy. That they don't produce a competent class that is not accountable, or they don't depress the power of ordinary citizens. How to intervene by exalting rather than depressing negative power of judgment, a power that, after all, controls and monitors by revealing. Now, the question were early on captured by Tocqueville when he explained that freedom of speech can engender unpleasant outcomes, but cannot be limited if democracy is to endure. The law cannot intervene because coercion is not the solution to the problem, but the origin of any problems. Then how can we solve the problem of preserving free speech and yet treating opinion as a sovereign power that needs checks and balances, regulation, not to become absolute or oppressive? It is the nature of the power of opinion that can perhaps lead us to give a pertinent answer to this question. I'm going toward the end now. If we follow the traces of the hierarchy of the will and judgment that I have introduced at the start, we may find out that the formation of opinion through the press, the means of information, and the social and political movements are, along with voting and the decision-making process within the institution, that which constitutes the complex universe of modern democracy. In substance, we become aware of the fact that free speech is a kind of freedom that creates power and moreover requires an active state, as Owen Fist effectively wrote in 1986. As a matter of fact, in the moment judgment is contemplated as a component of democratic sovereignty, constitutional democracy cannot avoid taking care of the circumstances in which political judgment gets shaped. Taking care of the circumstances of opinion formation and the expression of ideas, making sure that the monitoring power of information is never obstructed by those who are in charge of government, it entails acting indirectly, yet acting nonetheless. And I quote from Fis: protecting autonomy by placing a zone or non-interference around the individual is likely to produce a public debate that is dominated and thus constrained by some forces that dominate social structures, not a debate that is uninhibited, robust, and wide open. So the key to the solution of the problem facing contemporary democracy lies in considering free speech as also a political right of the citizen, not only a right and a private right of the individual. Thus, turning our attention from electoral authorization to indirect forms of influence and participation is crucial. The invitation is to democratic citizens and lawmakers to refine their institutional imaginations in view of endowing democracy of new means, legal and constitutional, that are able to strengthen and sharpen the function of transparency and control held by public opinion to take care of the condition of public discourse. Written before the technological revolution of the means of communication, none of the constitutions of Western democracies is effectively equipped to protect the right of information and the pluralism of the sources of information as a right of equal importance as the right to vote. Some constitutions are better equipped than others. Article 5 of the German Constitution declares, I quote, that anybody has the right to freely express and diffuse his opinions with words, written materials, and images, and to be informed without impediment through sources that should be accessible to all. The Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union is landmark on this issue. Article 11 is explicitly devoted to freedom of expression and information. Approved in 2000, the EU Charter capitalizes on recent history. It signals the risk that representative democracy can face because of the monopolization of the media and, more generally, the extraordinary power of private and corporate money in politics and organization of public opinion, creating or exacerbating partisanship in the view of influencing the political sphere or, finally, the very parliaments. So, rather than the power of irrational majorities, we see here in action a new form of classical assault on democracy by the few in a very strategic way, as Cass Sunstein has also illustrated. So the EU Charter suggests us the right direction, that of refurbishing democracy's institutional imagination in four fields in which the impact of the formation and circulation of opinion is huge. And I will simply sketch them to conclude. The four fields. First of all, it would be necessary to resist and counter the opacity in the process of interdependence between elected representatives and the citizens. The leading criterion is that in a representative democracy, the right to vote doesn't entail solely the right to form a majority, but also that of being represented. Thus, the mode of formation and selection of candidates and the channels of communication between representatives and citizens through the electoral mandate are crucial issues for a decent democratic practice of voting rights. Political parties should not be allowed, as Bruce Ackerman recently wrote, to steal from the citizens the right to voice their claims and reduce them to simply plebiscitarian choosers of yes and no preferences. As a general criteria of representative democracy, citizens should have the chance to participate in defining candidacies, claims, and political goals, not only voting. Second, it would be necessary to regulate and limit the use of private economic resources in electoral campaigns and the political spheres more generally. Ronald Dworkin wrote brilliantly on this issue. This is a very tricky issue because while the disposal of money in politics has a direct correlation with an equal opportunity all the citizens should enjoy to co-participate in the formation of the public political consent, it is certain that it has also a direct impact on citizens' actual opportunity to express their voice. So since the liberal inception in 17th century, property rights and freedom of expression have been mutually supporting allies. Yet in a representative democracy in which people's political presence happens or occurs by indirect means, the public check on private money in the political sphere and the sphere of information can hardly be avoided. As a matter of fact, since the ancient time, this has been always a problem. So since, if you pay attention to what's happened recently in America concerning the decision of the Supreme Court, this is truly frightening, because with that decision of January 2010, the Supreme Court decided to allow corporations full freedom of financing politics and electoral campaigns with an argument that is truly problematic, namely by giving them, recognizing them as persona juridica, with the same individual rights that we as individual citizens have. So this implies a new conception of the citizen, a new conception of egalitarianism in the distribution of political power. Third, it would be crucial to protect the independence of the public system of information from the power of political majorities, those elected in parliaments. This can be done by creating a public space accountable to and guarded by an authority. Perhaps you in the UK you have this kind of power that it's unique in some sense in the Western democracy, a kind of authority that should be equally distanced from the will of the majority and that of the minorities. The leading logic of this proposal is the disassociation of the public system of judgment from the power of the will. There should be truly a diarchia, to make it an expression of the complex and pluralistic world of opinion, a public agent of the most exquisite sense. Fourth and the last, it will be necessary to guard and defend the pluralism of the sources of information and opinions by putting constraints on the market of information, and in particular by impeding the growth of monopoly, private or public, in the media system and the press, but also by preventing citizens. I realize that this is very radical, but I like to put on the floor and to discuss with you, by preventing citizens who own or are in the board of trustees of media corporations and television networks to run for election, to pay elected leaders or members of the government and social service. That is, modern democracy needs to rethink and to adapt to its own condition new forms of ostracism. Ostracism by which I mean not the expulsion of the citizen from the nation, of course, but limitation in the liberty to run for power as a strategy for protection of democratic liberty. So giving the equal right to vote for candidates, restrictions should be contemplated in the right to run for elections and being a candidate. And thus I come truly to the conclusion. So field 3 and 4 entail we revisit what is a consolidated tradition in liberal democratic society, namely the disdain of any intrusion in the marketplace of ideas. Yet the market is not a spontaneous self-regulating domain, let alone a natural setting of human relations. It is an institution that relies on a quite strong system of norms and rules without which the market can generate its own negation, that is, monopoly. The paradigm of the market of ideas would need to contemplate an equal attention to and the careful maintenance of the pluralist requisite. The Madison strategy, divide et impera logic, all the more so because in this specific case, the idea of it as a jungle, the market as a jungle in which only the fittest survive, runs against the democratic principle, which, as we said at the beginning, accords to everyone, not only the fittest or the majority, the right to be heard. I conclude by returning to the implication of treating democracy as a diarchia of will and government and judgment. The implication is the following. A democratic answer to the liberal critics of the tyrannical potential of opinion should consist in making information a public good and communication a public good, not a private, simply question of private freedom, and free speech a fundamental component of the right to citizenship, not simply the right of the individual. Information is a public good because it allows a citizen to acquire other goods, such as, for instance, monitoring the constituted power, disclosing what the power tends to conceal, with the risk of facilitating corruption, incompetence, and an arbitrary use of state power. Moreover, because it enables citizens to make their political choices, simply, which doesn't need to be good choices, simply they should be choices made by different options. Information belongs to the honorable tradition of the negative powers, even if its action is informal and its effects are indirect. So without normative forms of control that treat free speech as a component of the political right to citizenship, modern democracies are at risk, though the right to vote is not violated. And even though there is no longer, not even in the imaginary, the idea of an elsewhere from democracy. Thank you.